Welcome to Slate's spoiler special for The Black Dahlia, the new Brian De Palma film. I'm Brian Curtis, a writer at Slate, and I'm joined by Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic. Now, the spoiler special is where we give away all the secrets and surprises from the movie. So if you haven't seen the movie and you still want these secrets to be preserved, please stop listening right now. Hi, Dana.
Hi, how are you, Brian?
So, Dana, usually on these spoiler specials, we sort of give away the surprises at the end of the movie. But let's admit up front that this movie makes absolutely no sense, even after sitting all the way through it. So let's just hit a few of the plot points, sort of briefly summarize what happens, and then hit just a very few of the spoilers, because I think any sort of extended discussion is just going to make us both confused.
It'll be a hopeless tangle if we try to figure out all these threads. But I think we both agree that there are a few glaring problems with the way the movie is plotted out.
So what you first need to know is that there are two cops, Josh Hartnett and Aaron Eckhart, who play Bucky and Lee. And Lee's girlfriend is played by Scarlett Johansson. So as these cops go out to investigate this murder of the Black Dahlia, a woman sort of gruesomely murdered in a field, there are two more murders in this movie. The first murder is of Lee himself, and he is killed by Dana.
Well, tell me if I get this wrong, but as I gather in that climactic scene on top of a staircase, Lee is killed by a combination of Georgie, the sort of perverted clown figure who turns out to be also one of the murderers of the Black Dahlia, just to spoil one more for you, and Hilary Swank playing a young sort of perverse heiress named Madeline, who you see appearing in silhouette at the top of the stairs. I believe that those two, were acting on behalf of the Lynn Scott family, are responsible for hurling Lee down that circular flight of stairs, where he dies that very Untouchables-like kind of death.
Yes. And speaking of the Lynn Scott family, we now move to the second murder, which is the murder of the Black Dahlia, this actress named Elizabeth Short, who's found in the field. And she is murdered, according to the De Palma movie, by...
Well, once again, we may have to puzzle this out together, but as far as I can tell from the many convoluted explanations at the end, Georgie, the perverted clown, wants the Black Dahlia dead because he's a sort of Jeffrey Dahmer-like creep who likes to be around dead things, but is not actually a murderer himself. Therefore, his dirty work is done for him by Ramona Lynn Scott, the mother of Hilary Swank's character, who's this great sort of drunken drag queen, very campy older woman. And she does in the Black Dahlia and sort of serves her up to Georgie for carving up to his delight. It's a very perverse ending, but I believe that those are the two actual killers, whereas the whole Lynn Scott family is sort of knows about it and is implicated in the cover-up, hence the killing of Lee Blanchard.
So for spoiler purposes, each murder is committed by a member of the Lynn Scott family and their perverted playmate, whose name we think is Georgie.
That's right. Blame the clown, Brian. Always blame the clown. You can't
always
go wrong.
A good idea. And that also explains, we should say, why Hilary Swank's character, Madeline Lynn Scott, looks like Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia. There's this resemblance between the two of them that's pointed
out. Well,
there's
not any family resemblance between them. It's not as if Elizabeth Short is the illegitimate daughter of anyone. So that supposed resemblance between Hilary Swank and Mia Kirshner, who plays the Black Dahlia and who in fact doesn't resemble Hilary Swank at all, couldn't yeah, be familial. But it could certainly be that Georgie's interest, if we're going to start psychologizing the non-character of Georgie, his interest is sparked by the fact that this young prostitute actress resembles his illegitimate daughter. Let's go with that.
I see. Sounds good.
Yeah, the movie hangs on a resemblance that doesn't really exist, which you'd be a lot more willing to forgive if the movie in general hung together as a whole. Now, what about the story of, I don't know if you were going to bring this one up, but about Scarlett Johansson and Aaron Eckhart's characters collaborating on this bank heist that they've hidden away the money from? Did that one make any sense for you?
I think I went to sleep during that part, actually. But because I seem to, at the end of the movie, what we find out is that there's this sort of you could call it a mild love triangle between Bucky, the Josh Hartnett character, Lee, the Aaron Eckhart character, and Scarlett Johansson's character, whose name is Kay Lake. Kay Lake and Lee Blanchard are actually together, and Josh Hartnett is kind of hanging around them like a sad little puppy. Well, after Lee dies, Hartnett and Johansson get together. But after they get together, Hartnett finds in the Johansson house all this illicit money from a bank heist. And can you clue me in on where this money came from?
I mean, once again, I'm sure that it's hastily explained in one of those, you know, backward-looking sort of summaries that characters are constantly blurting out in this movie. But I guess the idea was that Blanchard had been in on that whole bank heist that they kill some people over at the beginning. Remember the whole excuse that, you know, that they're out on a, when they're out on a mission together and happen to run into the Black Dahlia's body being discovered, right? Is that there was a bank heist by a guy named, oh, what the hell was his name? I don't remember. Anyway, there's a bank heist in the past. And as it turns out, Lee Blanchard has been squirreling away money from it and getting payoffs all of these years to keep it quiet. Right. And somehow the Linscott's are involved in that. I mean, once again, if we start getting into this, we're going to get 10,000 reader mails of people with theories about what was going on in this. But I don't think that the movie explains it adequately. And that's the main point. Not that we're such idiots we didn't get it. That's a debatable question. Right. But that Brian De Palma doesn't really bother to map it out for us very clearly. I think that he somehow thinks there's going to be enough, you know, glitz and enough blood and enough sex that it's just going to somehow slide on by. And for me, it didn't work.
To call this movie overplotted would be totally generous. Our former colleague David Edelstein writes in New York Magazine this week that he read the book twice and still had no idea what the hell was going on when he saw the movie. So for those of us who have not read the book twice, you can only imagine the confusion.
Well, if we're going to get just away for a moment from just explaining what happened and just talk a little bit about some aspects of the movie without worrying about spoiling, which is what I love about these spoiler specials, let's just talk about the fact that Lee Blanchard's character, Aaron Eckhart, who's one of the main, you know, obviously the two sort of cop protagonists of the movie, buys it about halfway through and sort of disappears from the rest of the movie, even as a presence that anyone remembers. I mean, to me, this was a big weakness in the movie as well. I just thought that the movie seemed too eager to do away with him and turn him into a villain after having, you know, built him up as one of the two heroes for the first 30, 40 minutes.
And worse, I thought Aaron Eckhart was the only sort of actor who did good work in this movie, who had a major role. You know, I thought Josh Hartnett cannot act his way out of a paper bag. Scarlett Johansson.
Oh, yeah, all the
miserable
life just drains out of the movie when Aaron Eckhart leaves. So actually, when he bought it in that stairwell, I just kept hoping that somebody had substituted another body at the last minute, Vertigo style or something, so we'd get a little bit more Aaron Eckhart and a little bit more juice in the movie. But sure enough, that was the end of him right there. Oh, here's a big plot hole. What was the deal with the sort of Jewish hotelier guy incinerating the body of a cop and getting away with it? I mean, you see him putting Aaron Eckhart's body, along with the body of his killer, into this big incinerator in the hotel and sort of wink-wink making this deal with Josh Hartnett, we're not going to tell anyone about it. And that storyline drops out entirely, too, and suddenly the whole police force seems to know that Lee Blanchard is dead and incinerated and is perfectly fine with it.
Right, and we're supposed to think, I think, that the hotel owner runs things to such an extent in Los Angeles that people, including cops, can be murdered in his hotel, and he won't even have to report the crime. He just throws them in the basement incinerator. In a different movie, that would be sort of an interesting sort of plot twist, but in a movie where the movie isn't completely about something else,
it's a very Elroy-esque plot twist, although the incineration of Lee by the hotel guy doesn't happen in the novel, but it's that sort of level of corruption of the police force in Los Angeles would be exactly the kind of detail Elroy would love. But De Palma just sort of throws it in there without any follow-up, so it ends up just making no sense.
Please send your letters to Brian De Palma, not to Dana Stevens or Brian Curtis. It's not our fault.
Any last thoughts on the Black Dahlia?
No, I don't want to think about it anymore.
You want to dump it in a field and let it lie there unsolved?
I know. That seems like too cruel an analogy, but let's go with it. So Dana Stevens, our Slate movie critic, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Brian.
For Slate.com, I'm Brian Curtis.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.